Well, it's the night before the last night of Rohatsu. And for many years at our Loon Lake Sesshin, at the end of practice period, when we've had a shuso, or a head monk, it's around this time, either the last or the next and last night, that the shuso gives a talk in the evening. And the plan this year was for Daikan to be our shuso. So I really wish he were here instead of me. But the best laid plans often do go awry. And when health issues arose for Daikan, it became clear that he wouldn't be able to be shuso. So because our friends from Wall Street are joining us tonight, I felt it would be good to have a talk. Anyway, for some of you, this talk will be a review, because I am going to reprise a talk I did actually just a couple of weeks ago. But many of you weren't there. And also, it makes a good bedtime story. So, the story is case 56 of the Book of Serenity. And it's our old friend Dongshan, who is on a pilgrimage with his frequent traveling companion, Shanshan. Shanshan was a fellow student with Dongshan of their teacher Yunyan. And we get the idea from these many stories about them that they knew each other for decades. And many of Dongshan's students, once they were older, called Shanshan, Sung Mi, which means Uncle Mi.
Aww.
Yeah, so he was Uncle Mi, M-I, spelled M-I. And Shanshan, or Sung Mi, often seems to be kind of the fall guy in these stories, setting up Dongshan for a penetrating insight. And yet, when you take these stories as a whole, we can't help thinking that it's just part of their playful relationship. And they both know perfectly well what's going on, these old Dharma friends. So here they are once again. And in this koan, Shanshan is called Sung Mi, Uncle Mi. They're going along a mountain path, and a white rabbit crosses in front of them. And Sung Mi says, "Wow, that was fast." Dongshan, "How so?" Sung Mi, "Like a commoner being made a prime minister." Dongshan, "How can a venerable old person like you say such a thing?" Sung Mi, "Well, what would you say? Here's the setup." Dongshan, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." "Well, what does all that mean?" That word that's translated as swift or fast, like the rabbit going across the road, can also mean noble, eminent, refined. So the sense is this rabbit is not only fast, but noble. So I think it would help us to realize that the rabbit has a special place in Chinese and Japanese culture, and in ancient Buddhist lore. In Japan, instead of a man in the moon, people see a rabbit pounding mochi with a mortar and pestle. So take a look next time. The story of how the rabbit came to be in the moon is based on one of the ancient Indian folk tales called Jataka tales. And these are tales of the Buddha's previous lives as a bodhisattva before he became a Buddha. They're teaching stories, they're kind of fables. And often the Buddha is an animal in these stories. So here's this one. Long, long ago, the bodhisattva, it always says the bodhisattva and it means the Buddha in a past life, was born as a hare. The hare had three friends, an otter, a jackal, and a monkey. as this story traveled from India to China to Japan, the animals changed. They're not always exactly the same animals. The jackal became a fox by the time it got to Japan. So these three friends decided they would practice generosity on the day of the full moon by giving food to someone needy. The otter swam off down the river to forage for some food. He came upon a fisherman's camp where 7 fish were laid out on the bank to dry, strung on a stick. "Oh, someone must have forgotten these fish," he said, and he grabbed them and jumped back in the river. The jackal caught an enticing smell coming from a farmer's hut. He peeked into the doorway, and seeing no one there, he darted inside and grabbed a stack of 7 freshly buttered chapati from beside the fire. The monkey went off to an orchard he knew of, and sure enough, the mangoes were perfectly ripe, and he picked 7 of the largest ones. Of course, the exact foods also changed with culture as this story traveled. And in Japan, it was persimmons instead of mangoes. The otter, the jackal, and the monkey were feeling quite pleased with themselves. But the hare still hadn't found anything but grass. In the meantime, Chakra, the king of the gods, heard of the animal's plan by means of his godly omniscience and decided to test them. He disguised himself as an old beggar and made his way toward the clearing where the animals had planned to meet. First, he came upon the otter stretched out in the sun by the riverside. "Friend, can you spare some food for an old man?" he asked. "Of course," said the otter. He ducked into his den and came out with 5 of the fish and gave them to the old man. "Here, eat well." "Thank you, kind sir." The otter felt quite virtuous. Remember how many fish there were? Yeah. Okay. Next, the old man came to the jackal. "Friend, can you spare a bite to eat for a traveler?" "Certainly, sit right down." The jackal trotted off to the bushes where he'd hidden the chapatis and brought back 5 of the 7 for the old man. "Here, eat well." "Thank you, kind sir." The jackal, too, felt quite virtuous. Next, the old man came to the monkey. "Friend, have you anything for a hungry old man?" "Certainly, wait right here." The monkey climbed the tree where he'd hidden the mangoes and brought back 5 for the old man. "Here, eat well." "Thank you, kind sir." The jackal, too, felt very virtuous. Finally, Chakra, disguised as the old man, came to the clearing where the hare was waiting for his friends, who came trailing behind out of curiosity. "Friend, I have been traveling for days with hardly anything to eat. I'm weak with hunger. Can you spare me something?" Without hesitation, the hare replied, "Please sit down. I will prepare something for you." He had already gathered some dried grasses and twigs. Now he lit them on fire and saying, "I have only my body to give. Please be nourished." And he jumped into the fire. But to the hare's surprise, the flames felt cool, and they did not even singe his fur. He looked out at the old man, but in his place stood the resplendent king of the gods. "Come out of the fire, little one," said Chakra. "You have offered a brave and selfless gift. I want everyone to remember your example of generosity." At that, Chakra rose into the sky all the way to the moon, where he painted an image of the hare on the full round disc. In the Chinese version of the story, Chakra becomes 3 Taoist immortals and rewards the hare by sending him to live on the moon with the goddess Chang'e, where he helps her prepare the elixir of immortality with his mortar and pestle. How the goddess got to the moon is another story. And in Japan, the hare and the moon pounds mochi, sticky rice, to make mochi cakes. So one thing I want to say about this story, because it's a little, you know, the image, of course, of the rabbit throwing himself into the fire can be disturbing. It's kind of like the traditional morality tales of other cultures in that it's a teaching story about generosity. And though the message might seem to advocate self-immolation, I think the key message here is about the other animals holding back. As we all tend to do. What makes us hesitate to fully offer our gifts to the world? I don't think this story is about reckless self-sacrifice. There are people and animals who put their own lives at risk to help save the young. Right? As I looked again at this story, wrote this story again, I immediately recalled three examples of parents who died drowned, trying to save their children from drowning. Perhaps you have heard of examples. One was the beloved Zen teacher, Kobunchino Roshi. And then, of course, there's Doctors Without Borders and those who work in disaster relief. I've read studies of interviews with people who have risked their lives in acts to save others that we deem as heroic, who receive awards for being heroic. And often they say there was never a thought of heroism. They don't think of themselves as heroes, that they could not have done otherwise than reach to save. Like that old Zen story of the one hand reaching to adjust the pillow behind the head, you know, one body. With all this in mind, maybe now we can understand how that white rabbit instigated this exchange between the two old friends. This was no ordinary rabbit, but one that embodied the wondrous qualities of a legendary being, as well as that quick zigzag run of an ordinary rabbit crossing their path. In the commentary to this koan, Wansong, who wrote the commentary, says, Sangmi's and Dongshan's comments represent two gates or approaches to awakening. Sangmi's was, like a commoner being made a prime minister, is the gate of practice. Wansong says, usually we awaken by means of practice, entering sagehood from ordinariness, like a commoner becoming a prime minister. In those days, long ago, the Chinese imperial exam system, by which candidates were chosen for positions in the government bureaucracy, was a meritocracy of sorts. It was compromised by family influence and bribery, but there were definitely examples of individuals rising from quite low ranks to positions of great power because of their success in the exam system. So we can see why this analogy was used for that long, slow path of determined practice leading to awakening. The second gate to awakening, Dongshan's generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty. This is the perspective that sees our inherent Buddha nature. Our Buddha nature, which is both impermanent and boundlessly interconnected with all existence. This perspective sees our clear apprehension of this reality clouded by our human greed, hatred, and delusion. This is Dongshan's analogy, our birthright, our Buddha nature, temporarily obscured, and we fall into poverty. We suffer in so many ways from our sense of lack and separation. And Wansong says, though we drift destitute in myriad conditions, the basic constitution is still there, the Buddha nature is still there. That made me remember the lines from Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen that we chant at the Zendo sometimes. like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst, like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor. Lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. And that is a direct reference to the parable from the Lotus Sutra that some of you may recall, of the son of a wealthy man, for reasons unspecified, leaves home, squanders his money, wanders in poverty, while his father searches for him for years. There are parents right now, today, who don't know where, whose children are living on the street, and the parents don't know where they are. When the father finally finds his son, the son does not even recognize him. He sees this finely dressed man approaching him with his retinue of servants, and he's so ashamed of his condition that he runs away. Most of us have experienced the power of shame, of being so terrified, of being shamed, that we hide and do not allow ourselves to be seen fully. And yet somehow, deep inside, we know that those shaming voices, those sneering voices, who do you think you are, we know they're wrong. Somewhere inside, we know they're wrong. It can take a long time for us to trust ourselves and others, like the son in the story, whose father first took him home and employed him to shovel out the stables, put him to work shoveling chit, and gradually gave him more and more responsibility. He had to cultivate and grow. The son had to cultivate and grow into his true nature, his nobility that was there all along. Or you could say he had to let go of the habit patterns and beliefs he'd accumulated in those years of living in poverty on the streets before his true nature was revealed. And then his father embraced him and gave him his inheritance, revealing that he had sewn a precious jewel in the hem of the son's robe that had been there all along. This is obviously a rather patriarchal story. And the commoner nobility analogy doesn't necessarily work entirely for our times. Our cultural myth is that hard work and determination lead to success. For me, growing up in the States, the cultural myth was if Abraham Lincoln, who was born in a one-room log cabin, could become president, you could too. Well, no woman has yet. And those who have come closest certainly did not grow up in a hardscrabble log cabin. Our culture still worships wealth and celebrity, if anything, even more than in Abraham Lincoln's time. And we still, as a society, resist taking an honest look at inequality. But this story is talking about another kind of nobility and another kind of equality. It's the deep, open-hearted compassion born of seeing that we are not separate from each other and all beings, that my well-being is utterly interdependent with the well-being of both Israelis and Palestinians, with the ecosystems of the boreal forest, though I've never seen them, those boreal forests that recover from wildfires so much more slowly than the forests here. This nobility, this equality is not always so easy to embrace, but it is the vow of the Bodhisattva to do so. So who was right? Songmi, saying that the white rabbit exemplified the commoner rising to be a prime minister through years of hard work and practice, or Dongshan, saying it was like a noble person falling temporarily into poverty. I think both of them knew perfectly well that it's not one or the other, but a dialectical process, two aspects of the same thing. And we've all probably experienced both. And how quickly one can turn into the other. We can fall from nobility into poverty in an instant of anger and harsh words. We can awaken to our true nobility even in the midst of great suffering. with the purity, naturalness, and swiftness of the white hare. Every single one of us. It's been a fall Sesshin tradition to have a song, a kind of lullaby, the last or the next to last night of Sesshin. Often when we've had a shuso, the shuso sings it. But as I mentioned, Daikan would have been here, so he can't. And I was thinking I might help him anyway. So this song is for Daikan. And you'll see now why I had to tell the koans the white rabbit story again. Because the name of this song is The Snow Hare. And it's from the poem it's based on is from a book called Lost Spells by Robert McFarlane, who also wrote a book called The Lost Words, beautifully illustrated. And this is The Snow Hare set to music. I'm going to ask Mick to put on original sound. And I will try this. The hair turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the rain is falling. The hair turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the dark is rising. By the loch of the birds, he hunkers down in the heather. He waits for the veil of snow to come and cover him over. The snow hare hides in the mountain moss. Oh, the sleet is falling. The snow hare hides in the mountain moss. Oh, the dark is rising. By the cairn of the goose, he hunkers down in the heather. He waits for the veil of snow to come and cover him over. The hare, he waits on the highest hill, but the snow is no more falling. The hare, he waits on the highest hill. Oh, the dark is rising. By the rock of the stag, he hunkers down in the heather. He waits for the veil of snow to come and cover him over. Ooh. Sleep well. Good night, everyone. Let us chant the refuges together. It's just time.